Gamarjoba, and welcome to the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is Episode 7, Sawarmag, Mirvan, Parnajom, and Arshak. In this episode, we're going to blitz our way through a long list of Iberian kings because, quite frankly, we don't know a lot about their reigns and the sources are quite lacking. I searched for about as much as I could, but there is only so much that we know. Mind you, whatever extra information we do get is from the Kartli Shovrieva, or the Life of Kartli, which is not the most reliable of sources. So when it does come up, be sure to take it with a grain of salt. In the last episode, we covered the ascendance of King Pharnavaz of Iberia, the first Georgian-born king of Kartli. Through his biblically long reign, he united the Georgian region under his authority. When he died in 234 BC, the throne passed to his son, Sawarmag. We know less about Sawarmag than we do about Pharnavaz. You would think that a guy who ruled for over 65 years would have some records about his son, but to be honest, there isn't much that we can really elaborate on. As far as the ancient record keepers were concerned, the start of Sawarmag's life was when he took the throne. Sawarmag ruled from 234 BC to 159 BC. His name is Ossetian in origin and means black-handed. Some scholars believe that Sawarmag may instead have been Pharnavaz's ascetic son-in-law. However, in this podcast, we're going with the assumption that he is Pharnavaz's legitimate son until we can prove it otherwise. Interestingly, Sawarmag was a religious reformer. He added gods to the Iberian pantheon, namely Ainina and Danina. So what is their godly domain in this pantheon? No clue. The chroniclers say nothing, and my searching has brought up zero results. These were just addendums to the main pantheon of the sun, moon, and five planets. Honestly, we probably won't find much religious information about the Georgian pantheon, but I promise to give you all as much as I can. On to other matters. Sawarmag used his blood relations to integrate the Ossetians and Chechens, or the Zurzuks, into his kingdom. He took the Caucasus into the upper Aragvi Valley, into his borders, and half the Chechen nation along with it. Local place names do confirm a Chechen migration. With the Chechens now within the folds of the Iberian kingdom, this supplied Kartli with fearsome fighters, or at times, ungovernable looters. Sawarmag was known for his policy of bringing in useful immigrants into his nation. Mitizhieta's Darnavi quarter is dated all the way back to 169 BC and reflects the arrival of Iberia's Jews. The urban population over the next century began to include Syrian, Armenian, and Iranian communities. It's possible that Jews, Armenians, and Syrians had prominent positions in the urban communities of Caucasian Albania. Now, on the international front, here is where Pharnavaz's carefully constructed peace begins to get dicey. Sawarmag continued his father's tributary status to the Seleucid kingdom that controlled Anatolia and Syria. However, they were not as powerful as they once were, and their unity was broken by Pontus, a strong kingdom from the southeast Black Sea coast region. Pontus captured most of the Black Sea coast during the reign of King Pharnacus I, causing the loss of Trebizond to the Armenians. Pharnacus then turned east, conquered and annexed southern Colchis, and began to threaten Iberia. The Iberians turned to their suzerain, the Seleucids, for help. Things weren't sunny for the Seleucids either, because to the east and southeast of Iberia, another threat was gaining strength, which had begun to form during the reign of Pharnavaz. This threat, the Parthians. In 247 BC, Arshak made himself king of Parthia. At this time, however, relationships between the Iberians and Parthians were rather friendly, and they even worked together to fight a resurgent Armenian state that was exploiting the feuds of the Seleucids. But for some reason, Sawarmag's relationship with the Parthians was not working out so hot, and without their help, the Armenians took the southern Tau region, north of Izurum, Turkey, by the time of his death. In fact, the whole world as Sawarmag knew it was crashing down. Alexander the Great's death collapsed his empire almost as quickly as he captured it everywhere but Egypt. By the 2nd century BC, the Roman Republic was impinging on Asia Minor and began clashing with the Seleucid king Antiochus III. These battles did not go great for Antiochus, and he was forced to surrender all of Anatolia north of the Taurus Mountains over to the Romans in 188 BC. The Seleucid defeat by the Romans benefited Armenia, who took this chance to take Mede and Iberian territory. Pharnavaz's kingdom was crumbling in the hands of Saramag. The Argeveti district, which was used to demarcate the borders between Colchis and central Iberia, completely went over to the Colchians, and Colchis, using this opportunity to split away from Kartli, became an autonomous kingdom. Colchis Interlude. Very important note. Colchis, despite being the better known name between Colchis and Iberia, thanks to Jason and the Argonauts, is lacking immensely in sources. I'll be doing a Colchis interlude while we are focusing on Iberia Kartli. I'll mention all the interesting tidbits for sure. By 150 BC, Colchis was minting silver coins, and parts of Colchis assimilated their North Iranian invaders. Pliny the Elder mentions a King Saulasses, which means blackface, in the 2nd century BC, who was exporting gold and silver. Now, it pains me to say, while I'd love to cover Colchis in more detail, we honestly have less information about Colchis than we do about Iberia. According to Strabo, Colchis was rather fragmented and was ruled over by a high king, the aforementioned King Saulasses. We really only know of two earlier Colchian kings, that being Kuji and, way further back, King Aedes. King Saulasses also seems quite mythical, but we know he existed since we have coins that give us his name. Back to Kartli. The loss of land, especially over Colchis, was too much for the Georgian nobility to handle. They saw how Saramag was undoing his father's achievements and attempted to assassinate him. They wanted to be free to rule their own lands as they had once done in the past, but of course, would band together and pay tribute for a strong leader who would overcome them in battle, just as Pharnavaz had done. Saramag, finding out about the plot, managed to escape to his mother's land of Chechnya. The Asnauris, who were Macedonian soldiers who gave their loyalty to Pharnavaz upon betraying Azo, continued their pledge of loyalty to the Pharnavazid line, as they could find no way better to repay the debt they held to Pharnavaz than by aiding his son and successor. If Pharnavaz ruled for 65 years, then how are the Asnauris still alive? Okay, continuing. Saramag did not waste his time away from the capital, and met with his cousin, the king of the Ossetians, and asked for his aid. The Ossetian king consented, and they gathered both the Ossetians and the Durzuk forces against his disloyal subjects. The Durzuks were known for their aptitude and ferocity in battle, and none of his treasonous subjects could stand against him. Saramag managed to seize Kartli and destroyed many of those who raised a dagger to him, but to a select few, he granted clemency. Many of the Kartlosids, those descending from the mythical Kartlos, lost many of their rights. The Asnauris, on the other hand, in return for their loyalty, were raised to the rank of nobility. Saramag then took half of the Durzuks and raised them to the rank of nobility as well, and the other half being settled in Svaneti. To complement his administration, Saramag then placed members from his mother's family in key positions to be his supporting force. Having just been involved in a civil war, Saramag multiplied the amount of strongholds in Mitiskieta and all over Kartli. With his power now solidified, Saramag decided to make some powerful marriages. He married a Persian woman, who was a daughter of an Iranian official from Barda, unnamed. Together, they had two daughters, but no son. Needing an heir, he adopted the kinsman of his wife, named Mirvan, or Mirian in some sources, and married him to his daughter, and as part of her dowry, gave the town of Gakhiani and the Sayari Stavel of Samshfilde. His other daughter was married to his cousin, the son of Kuji. Soon, however, Saramag passed from this life, and Mirvan succeeded to the throne of Kartli. Mirvan is assumed to have reigned from 159 BC to 109 BC, continuing the trend of having a rather long reign, with little to no substance in the sources regarding it. Compared to his father, Mirvan was much better liked by his nobility, but had less written about him. Better to be remembered as a villain than not be remembered at all, I guess. Although, I might be biased considering that I'm constantly working against sparse sources, if I haven't already mentioned that. Hint hint, I have. According to whichever monk contributed to this part of the Georgian Chronicles, Mirvan was considered a very handsome, powerful, fearless, full of valor, and the epitome of health. Is this a priest crush? Anyways, if you thought he would be king without some sort of infighting, you'd be more than wrong. The Duurzug tribe, previously empowered by Mirvan's adoptive father, King Saruman, completely forgot their previous loyalties to the Iberian throne, especially now that they didn't have any direct blood descendant on that throne. They crossed the Caucasus Mountains and began ravaging and capturing the population of Kakheti. Mirvan was not going to stand for this and summoned the Aristavis of Kartli and gathered his troops. They set out for the land of the Duurzug tribe, Chechnya. They crossed the Caucasus Mountains, but the Duurzugs were ready and had established strongholds along the Darial Pass. Approaching this mountain pass, the valiant Mirvan got off his horse, went to his infantry, and placed himself at their head with his cavalry behind him and the infantry. He then led an assault on Duurzug's gates and both sides clashed. The Duurzug's ferocity seemed to leave Mirvan unfazed, and as they attacked him, it seems their blows left him unharmed, as if he were a tower made of stone. Yeah, the monk who wrote this definitely wasn't biased. The battle ended with Mirvan's victory and the death of countless people on both sides. The Duurzugs were routed, but the Georgians managed to encircle them and destroyed most of the army and took some captives with them. Mirvan was not done with his retribution and decided to put the Chechens in check. He entered their cities and ravaged them. Returning to Kartli through the Darial Pass, he decided to erect the gate at the pass and named it Darabal, or, you know, Darial. Mirvan was beloved by the populace, and as he was one to bestow lavish gifts upon his subjects, he ruled with no fear of internal enemies after that. Externally, however, the problems for Kartli were forming. During Mirvan's reign, the tributary status to the Seleucids ended as their borders receded, and he could not halt the expansion of Pontus and Armenia. In 111 BC, Mithridates VI Eupator became king of Pontus and began absorbing everything but North Colchis into his empire. Oh, and it's that Mithridates, the Poison King. What alarmed the Kartveli was that Mithridates VI Eupator was seeking an alliance with the Armenians. To hold off Armenian efforts into Iberia, Mirvan married his daughter, whose name we don't know, to Artavasdes' son, Arshak. Mirvan soon passed away and the throne went to his son, Parnajon. Hi everyone, Roberto here. I hate asking for this, but as we get further and further into the history of Georgia, we get more sources and more things to cover. As I'm trying to go and get ahead with the narrative and research content for cultural episodes, I'd like to ask for your support. I'm not asking you to go ahead and subscribe on Patreon, because I don't have any Patreon ideas yet, or even to send me money. I'm just asking for your support in purchasing books off of my Amazon wishlist. I'm currently working two jobs to make ends meet, and some of these books get expensive really quick. I've bought a few already, but some books, especially those of Stephen H. Rapp, mainly the Studies in Medieval Georgian Historiography, are a bit pricey, and I'm always on the lookout for better sources. So, if you like and appreciate what we do, I am including the Amazon wishlist on the website and in the episode description. If you can't afford to help by purchasing books, telling a friend, reviewing us on iTunes, and following us on social media always helps. Thank you for your time. Now our focus turns to Parnajom. Parnajom ruled from 109 BC to 90 BC. I guess we're entering that time period where people stop living for so long and rule for normal amounts of time. Parnajom was not a wise ruler and was instantly shunned for his religious beliefs. This is where it gets weird. He was credited for using his time on the throne for creating city fortresses, the most notable being that of Zadeni, which is named after the god Zadin, who is a god of fruitfulness, and in that city fortress he erected an idol to Zadin. He even built the town of Naukari, which is known as Nekresi in Kakheti. And this is where things begin to diverge. Parnajom is mentioned to be a major fan of Zoroastrianism and brought in Persian priests and magi, settled them within Mithsketa and Kartli, and built temples for them. For the record, however, the archaeological evidence that we have does not support this. So, like, did he follow the Georgian pantheon, or was he a Zoroastrianist? Like, pick one, guys. Back to the topic at hand. The populace of Kartli began to hate Parnajam when he moved away from the Georgian gods, assumedly. It also didn't help that he kept losing land to his enemies, the Aristavi, ever conspiring, because, like, do they ever stop? Took this chance to send an envoy to the Armenian king Artavasdes and demanded that they send his son Arshak to Kartli, because his wife, Parnajam's sister, was also descended from the Farnavazids. If King Artavasdes sends his army, they will run Parnajam out of Kartli, and in exchange, his family can start a new dynasty, as the children of Arshak and his unnamed wife will carry the blood of Farnavaz. Seriously, why can't they give these women names? If she's so important, give her a name, please. King Artavasdes was highly enthusiastic about this demand and sent an envoy agreeing to their terms. However, just for his own security, since of course these are a bunch of treasonous Aristavis, he demanded that they send them hostages to ensure their loyalty. In exchange for the hostages, Arshak will come to Kartli and Artavasdes himself will shower them with gifts. The Aristavis quickly sent their hostages to Artavasdes, renounced their allegiance to Parnajam, and King Artavasdes advanced with his entire army to Kartli. The sources begin differing here in regards to what happens next. In the Kartli's Khovriba, Parnajam faces King Artavasdes of Armenia in a final showdown, and he calls for the support of any Georgians who remain loyal to his rule. Parnajam's army is then crushed by the Armenians, and Parnajam loses his life valiantly in the fierce battle near Tashir. In other sources, Parnajam meets a less valiant end and is murdered by his Aristavis with alleged Armenian support. In the end, the result is the same, and Parnajam lies dead. Parnajam's son Mirvan was only a year old and was taken to Persia by his tutor. King Artavasdes, now victorious, gave Kartli to his son Arshak to rule. All hail King Arshak of Kartli. And little is known about King Arshak himself. As we mentioned before, he had a claim to the Iberian throne via his marriage to a descendant of Farnavaz, and he reigned from 90 BC to 78 BC. His rule is suggested to have an unprecedented period of peace, as the destructive conflicts of Kartli and those outside of its borders came to a stop. He is credited with strengthening the Iberian-Armenian borders, especially that of Sunda city in Javakheti. It's quite surprising he'd do that since he is, you know, of Armenian descent. And that's all we know, really. He died, and his son Artag came to the throne. But that's for the next episode. Before we end today's episode, I just want to give a little spoiler for someone who's coming up next. It's a very famous Roman that we all know and love. His name? Pompey Magnus. Yes, the Romans have come to Iberia. Enter the Mithridatic Wars. Regarding the music used during the Colchis interlude soundbite, I'd like to credit my friend Megan Rich for playing the guitar for us. Thank you oh so much. It was great and I enjoyed it. As I've mentioned before, if we're not on any streaming service, please let me know and I'll attempt to get onto it. If you do have anything you want to say, feel free to look us up on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram as The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. On Twitter at History_Georgia, on our website at historyofsakartvelo.com, or on our email at thehistoryofsakartvelogeorgia@gmail.com. Sakartvelo is spelled S-A-Q-A-R-T-V-E-L-O. Madlba danachvamdis, and thank you for listening to The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. See you next time!